You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good afternoon and welcome. I'm David Wessel. I'm director of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy here at Brookings. Today we're going to ask a question that seems only slightly less scary today than it did about 6 weeks ago when the market was down, which is, are we ready for the next recession? I'm going to kick it off with a little bit of background, about 5 minutes, and then we're going to have one segment on fiscal policy, which I'll introduce later, one segment on monetary policy, and then my colleague Louise Shaner is going to come up here and moderate a panel among all the participants, at which time we'll invite you to give your questions. I want to warn everybody that this is very much on the record, and in case you've noticed, there's two cameras there. One of them is ours. This is being webcast. And one is belonged to C-SPAN. So the basic question is, are we ready for the next recession? In case you're wondering, we have recessions from time to time. And the only point on this slide is to remind you that they come at irregular intervals. I'm not a believer that you can say that recessions, that expansions die of old age. But it is a fact that it's been a long time since the U.S. was out of recession. You may not feel that way to a lot of people, but the recession ended in 2009, so we've had a long stretch. You can see we had some quarters of lousy growth and some periods of slow growth. And the question really we're asking today is, what if? What if we had the misfortune to be hit by a recession again? Is the fiscal authorities, Congress, taxes, and spending, equipped to do what it did the last time? Is the Fed equipped to do what it has done in the past to fight a recession? And I'm particularly interested in what happens if it happens sometime soon, because we don't know what our fiscal or monetary position will be a decade from now. And this is the reality we face. This simply shows you the debt-to-GDP ratio, the size of our federal debt as a fraction of the size of the economy. And the important thing to notice is that it's pretty high now. If you look, we haven't been this high since the end of World War II. At the end of World War II, debt came down rather sharply. Projections from the Congressional Budget Office suggest that's the current policy line, that at current policies, the debt-to-GDP ratio is headed higher and higher. My colleague Bill Gale and his co-author Alan Auerbach have drawn another line there, which shows you, well, what if interest rates stayed really low for a long time? And you can see it rises substantially less rapidly, but it's still pretty big. We have had big deficits during the period of the Great Recession. You can see there how deep it was in 2009. You can see the deficit has come down as the economy has improved, as Congress raised taxes, and as there was, by accident, a lot of spending restraint thanks to the sequester. You can see that the deficit is not getting much bigger in the near term, but it starts to get bigger during the end of the decade. But for a nation that has, like, a humongous federal debt, and which is proposing to raise, on current policies, to have deficits of 3% of GDP for the foreseeable future, it turns out the rest of the world is still willing to lend us a lot of money at very low interest rates. The yield on 10-year treasuries, the nominal yield that is not adjusted for inflation, is currently below 2%. And you can see here how unusual that is. Now, one of the things about fiscal policy in our country is that it automatically adjusts to recessions, and some of our panelists are going to talk about this, so I don't want to belabor it. But this is a nice chart based on CBO data. The dark blue there shows you the extent to which automatic stabilizers, that is, things that did not require Congress to do anything, kicked in during the Great Recession, and how much of the deficit was due to them. It's important to note that these automatic stabilizers do not include the big American Recovery Act. So this is just things that took place without any action from Congress. And you can see that they were a substantial fraction of the deficit we ran. For people, these slides are all online. We just gave a little list here of all the things that Congress did in addition to those automatic stabilizers. And the nice thing about this chart is you can see that although the TARP cost $600 billion when it was announced, $600 billion of the TARP was actually committed. In the end, CBO estimates the ultimate cost is only about $40 billion. And you can see the Congress did quite a few things during the Great Recession. And the question is, given that debt level that we have today and given the political environment, would we be willing to do that again? Would Congress be willing to do that again? I personally would be happy to do it again if we had another recession. Could we do it again? Then this comes to the question of monetary policy. Now, once upon a time, we believed that, well, you didn't really need too much fiscal policy if you had a recession because the Fed could cut interest rates. The point of this chart is pretty simple. The Fed has cut interest rates. They're at zero. If you look really carefully at the bottom there, they've managed to barely get it off the floor of zero, about a quarter percentage point. We used to think that interest rates couldn't go below zero. Now we're learning in the rest of the world that maybe they can go a little bit below zero. And we'll talk about that. This is a graph of the countries abroad that have negative interest rates. You can see that in Switzerland, there are 0.75 percentage point negative interest rates. That is, if a bank puts money on reserve at the Swiss National Bank, it has to pay the Swiss National Bank money. It doesn't get any interest rates. And, of course, the other thing the Fed did was QE, buying a lot of assets. And so when Ben Bernanke took over at the Fed, they had less than $1 trillion in assets, and today they have $4.5 trillion in assets. And one of the questions we'll ask is, so what's wrong with 5.5 or 6.5 or 7.5 trillion? Is there some limit to what the Fed could do with QE? And is there some reason to believe that additional quantitative easing wouldn't have the same effect as this did before? But again, this comes in a really unusual context. And the context here is that interest rates around the world are very low. This is a really nice chart taken from some, it's actually by some Bank of England economists, and it shows you what interest rates are around the world adjusted for inflation on 10-year government bonds. In other words, what we're seeing now is unusual. Rates are low, but it reflects a long period of rates being low. And the point here is that we have reason to believe that interest rates may be lower than normal for a long time. The trend begins well below the Great Recession. And the question is, in that context, will the Fed be stuck near zero for a long time, and how much will that limit their capacity? So could the Fed do more? Could Congress do more? And what would that more be? So to kick us off, we have three speakers, each of whom has a different cut on fiscal policy. Do we decide who's going first? Wendy Adelberg is going first from the Congressional Budget Office. I think I'm supposed to say she's speaking for herself and not the CBO or something like that. No, she's speaking for CBO. Great. And who's second? Ben Spielberg from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, who has a nice paper with Jared Bernstein that was posted on their website this morning, a link on our website, about ways in which we might want to expand the automatic stabilizers. And then the third is Phil Swagel, University of Maryland, formerly of the Bush Treasury, who will talk about how he sees things. Each of them will speak for 7 to 10 minutes, then I'll bring them all up here and we'll have a discussion. So, Wendy, it's all yours.
I do. I bet I can do it, but I bet you can do it faster. And that's not me. There I am. I'm the second one on the list. Super. So, hi, I'm Wendy Gettelberg from the Congressional Budget Office. I'm an Associate Director for Economic Analysis, and I'm delighted to be here to discuss this really important topic. So let me give you a quick roadmap of what I'll say. First, I'll briefly walk you through CBO's budget and economic projections, and I'll highlight some of the significant consequences that we see from our projections of high and rising federal debt. I'll also talk about how the economic projections influence our budgetary projections and the interplay of those two. And then finally, I'll talk about automatic stabilizers, the role of automatic stabilizers and fiscal policy during times of economic weakness. All right. Let me skip that one. This might look familiar because David just showed it. Under current law, revenues are projected to stay roughly constant as a share of GDP over the next decade. But With the aging of the population and rising healthcare costs, CBO projects a substantial boost to federal spending on Social Security and the government's major healthcare programs. So alongside rising federal interest payments, deficits are expected to increase from their current level of 2.9%, which is just a touch higher from the average of 2.8% over the past 50 years, to 4.9% in 2026. Which leads us to projections for federal debt held by the public. So if current laws generally remain in place, growing deficits are projected to raise federal debt held by the public to 86% by 2026. That's up from 74% in 2015 and almost twice the average of the past five decades. So some of the consequences of high and rising debt. So the focus of the discussion today is that increased borrowing would restrict policymakers' ability to respond to economic challenges, whether that's through an economic downturn or the result of a financial crisis. And that would make those economic challenges have larger negative effects both on the economy and on people's well-being. So in addition, just a more straightforward direct effect is that increased borrowing would increase the amount of interest that the federal government would have to pay, which would make it all that much harder to stabilize debt to GDP in the future. Harder to quantify is that we think that high and rising levels of federal debt increase the likelihood of a fiscal crisis. Now, such a crisis would certainly prevent policymakers with significant challenges and lead to significant negative impacts on the country. In our view, there's no particular tipping point at which we think that a fiscal crisis would occur. And certainly you'd think that investors should care not just about the level of federal debt, but also their expected trajectory of federal debt. But nonetheless, to be sure, a higher level of federal debt and a steeper trajectory of federal debt worsen those risks. So in addition, looking at that second bullet point, or sorry, the first bullet point, CBO estimates that sustained higher deficits lead to lower GDP, lower economic output in the longer term, by crowding out national saving and domestic investment, which is to say CBO estimates that higher federal borrowing crowds out private investment. I'm going to skip that slide. So I should say our projections of rising deficits over time are there despite the fact that we are also projecting improving economic conditions over the next several years. Beyond the next several years, so after 2019, CBO does not attempt to predict the timing or magnitude of economic fluctuations. So CBO's projections should be interpreted as the average of likely outcomes. In other words, those averages reflect CBO's projection that any cyclical strength or weakness after the next couple of years would be offset or counterbalanced by cyclical weakness or strength, such that GDP is projected to grow on average with potential in the latter part of the decade. We endeavor to set our forecast in the center of this distribution of possible outcomes. So with that in mind, what that means is that we see both upside and downside risks to our forecast. So, for example, GDP growth in our forecast might be too pessimistic over the next 5 years. So, for example, firms might respond to increases in overall demand by doing more robust hiring than CBO projects, and that would lead to faster increases in household income and consumer spending than we project. And on the other hand, of course, there are also downside risks. Our forecast might be too optimistic over the next 5 years. So, for example, increased tightness in labor markets may not lead to as fast of an increase in wages as we project, and that would, just as the flip side, lead to less consumer spending and less household spending over the next 5 years. International conditions could be worse than we anticipate. There could be more of a slowing in China than we project, and that would have spillovers on the U.S. economy. And, of course, as we are discussing today, the possibility exists that the economy might enter recession in the next several years. The current economic expansion is over 6 years old, which is slightly longer than the average expansion since 1945. Over the past 30 years, expansions lasting at least 6 years with a really low level of unemployment, as we see, have tended to fall into recession within 2 years. However, length of economic expansions vary greatly, as David said. And although the longest expansion in the last 11 business cycles has been 10 years, we see no statistical evidence that the length of a recovery or length of an expansion is in and of itself a prediction of an economy going into recession. Nonetheless, it's of course a risk. All right, so in the latter part of the projection, CBO projects that GDP will be 0.5% below the level of potential. And that's because we estimate that output's been roughly that much below potential over the last seven complete business cycles. So that projected output gap, you can barely see some daylight between those two lines at the very end of our projection. So that projected output gap has budgetary implications. So just as in the past, any cyclical strength or weakness that we project has budgetary implications through the automatic stabilizers. Oh, let me go back there. So automatic stabilizers are provisions in law that decrease government revenues or increase government expenditures when the economy goes into recession, and then do vice versa when the economy expands. And that's all without any additional actions taken on the part of the government, just as David said. Stabilizers tend to reduce the depth of a recession, and vice versa, tend to dampen expansions. Basically, stabilizers affect aggregate demand. So households and businesses who pay less in taxes or households who receive more in transfers, we think that those changes flow through to differences in, to changes in aggregate demand, which affect the economy. So this chart, which is very similar to the one David showed you, but with more history, shows what has happened to automatic stabilizers, the contribution of automatic stabilizers to the budget and history and our projection. CBO expects that if current law generally didn't change, automatic stabilizers going forward would be much smaller than they've been over the past 7 years. So, for example, for this fiscal year, CBO estimates that automatic stabilizers will add $89 billion to the deficit. That's about 0.5% of potential. So by comparison, from 2019 to 2015, CBO estimates that automatic stabilizers added on average about 1.5% of potential to deficits. In later years, automatic stabilizers are projected to continue to shrink, although they are influenced by that estimate, by that projection of an average output gap. So this table gives the numbers on how automatic stabilizers have responded to recessions in the past. In the recent recession, which was obviously severe, after four quarters, automatic stabilizers added the equivalent of 1.5% of potential to the deficit, and then after eight quarters, 2.1%. So previous recessions have generally seen smaller increases in the deficit from automatic stabilizers. So let's say about 1% after eight quarters over the previous three recessions. But again, also as David said, he stole a lot of my thunder, even after accounting for the role of automatic stabilizers, deficits are still cyclical. For example, automatic stabilizers account for much of the increase in deficit since 2008. And indeed, in recessions, deficits are typically increased both through automatic stabilizers and through active fiscal policy. Like automatic stabilizers, we estimate that active fiscal policy that lowers revenues or increases transfers also boosts aggregate demand and GDP. In the past, active fiscal policy has provided a short-run stimulus for at least a month, two-thirds of the time that the economy was in recession in any particular year. And in nearly every case, that stimulus involved a reduction in revenues. And in fact, about half the time, most of that stimulus was a reduction in revenues. Active fiscal policy has often had the reverse effect during economic expansions, dampening growth during boom times about half the time. So automatic stabilizers and changes in fiscal policy have different implications for budget projections. So by design, automatic stabilizers are budget neutral. But importantly, I should note that fiscal policies underlying the automatic stabilizers generally do have budget implications, which is to say that the policies underlying automatic stabilizers may affect revenues and spending even when the economy is operating at potential. I suspect we'll talk about that more later. But for active fiscal policy, reducing deficits to stimulate the economy without imposing comparable fiscal restraint in future years would reduce output and income in the longer run relative to what would have occurred with no changes in fiscal policy. Which is to say, CBO concludes that the estimates that the benefits of fiscal stimulus are temporary, but the costs are permanent, in absence of any offsetting changes to fiscal policy in the future. Now, I should say, some researchers come to a different conclusion, and they estimate that maintaining policies that boost overall demand in the short term have positive long-run economic effects, because basically the crowding out of that those increases in deficits create is more than offset by increases in potential that result from the stimulus, the initial stimulus. Which is to say, the increase in demand raises the economy's long-term potential by enough to offset the negative effects of crowding out. How significant that is really unclear, and figuring out how to net out any positive effects on potential with the negative effects from crowding out is really complicated, and so CBO doesn't incorporate this effect, but certainly we continue to look at it. So that's all I have. I know I'm over time. Thanks very much.
So I just want to start out by thanking David and the Hutchin Center for hosting this event today, and also thanking all of our fellow panelists and all of you for being here to talk about what we think is a really important topic. I also want to thank my co-author of the paper that we just released, Jared Bernstein. Thank you very much. I want to thank my co-author, Jared Bernstein, and all of our colleagues at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities who gave us really invaluable feedback as we developed the ideas that are contained within our paper. When I think about the question that motivates this event, are we ready for the next recession, I really think there are two answers to this question, a short answer and a long answer. And the short answer is no, we're not. But the long answer, I think, is really what motivated us to write this paper, and I think motivates a lot of the people who are also speaking here today. And it's still no, but it's we can be if we take the right lessons from our historical experience and start to prepare for it now. And so with that idea in mind, Jared and I in our paper try to outline two sets of broad recommendations that we think can really enhance our preparedness for the next recession before it hits. Those two broad recommendations are, first, we want to strengthen the automatic stabilizers that David mentioned and Wendy talked about. And the second is that even outside the automatic stabilizers, we think that there is architecture that we can either leverage or build in other programs such that when the next recession rolls around, if Congress is going to take countercyclical action, we can maximize the effectiveness of that countercyclical action. So I'm going to talk about those two broad policy areas, and then I'll give an example in each area of what we talk about in the paper just so you can get a flavor of what our recommendations are. So first, I'm going to talk about the strengthening of the automatic stabilizers. And Wendy gave a great overview of what automatic stabilizers are. Again, they're programs that expand when the economy is weak and contract when the economy is on its way to recovery. In our paper, we discussed three automatic stabilizers: unemployment insurance, SNAP, which was formerly called food stamps, and Medicaid. And just to give you a sense of what an automatic stabilizer looks like, if you consider something like unemployment insurance, why does it expand when the economy is weak and contract when the economy is on its way to recovery? When we're heading into recession and people lose their jobs, more people qualify for unemployment insurance compensation, so therefore government spending on that compensation increases, putting money in people's pockets, and that's the cause of the increased consumer demand that Wendy's talking about. Then when the economy is on its way to recovery and people are getting jobs again, fewer of them qualify for unemployment insurance compensation, and therefore government spending will then decline. So that's what we're talking about here when we're talking about automatic stabilizers. Now, the three programs that we discuss in the paper are particularly suited, in our view, for additional countercyclical stimulus as automatic stabilizers, because there's already an efficient administrative infrastructure in place which you can leverage for more countercyclical funds. And what I'm going to talk about is something called FMAP. What FMAP is it stands for Federal Medical Assistance Percentages, and it is the share of Medicaid funding that the federal government covers four states. So this ranges from 50% in some of the wealthier states like Massachusetts, for example, to a much higher percentage in states that are like, for example, Mississippi at 75%. And during the last recession and during the recession in 2001, the federal government boosted the FMAP, meaning it paid a higher share of state Medicaid costs. And this was a really effective form of countercyclical stimulus during those recessions because it's a form of state fiscal relief. You might know that states have balanced operating budget requirements. So during recessions, when their revenues are falling, there's a lot of pressure on states to either cut services or raise revenues to make sure they meet those requirements. And what boosting the FMAP does, or boosting the share of Medicaid spending that the federal government covers, is it lets states use what used to be their share to cover other aspects of their budget shortfall. So it's really effective in that respect to make sure that whatever service cuts or revenue increases states might have to undertake during a recession are not as severe as they might otherwise have to. So what we recommend in the paper is, because this has been done during the last two recessions and was effective, we think it's something that should be a part of permanent law, that this should happen automatically during future recessions. We want to make this an automatic stabilizer, that the federal government enhances FMAP when a recession hits. The other reason that that's really valuable is because it helps with the timing. If you make it into an automatic stabilizer, you can be more sure that it's not going to end too soon or begin too late when a recession rolls around. Now, the devil is in the details, and how you make sure that enhanced FMAP is going to trigger on automatically and then trigger off when the economy is on its way to recovery is somewhat difficult. What we do in the paper is offer two potential sets of triggers, which are economic indicators that can say, at this point, the economy is doing poorly, so we're going to turn this on, and then at this point, the need for the fiscal relief is no longer necessary, and we're going to try turning it off. The thing I want to emphasize is these triggers are inherently arbitrary to a large extent, so it's hard to design a perfect one, and we're not wedded to the two that we propose in the paper. We did want to give some options, but if people can come up with a better one, we're all for that. The main thing for us is that enhanced FMAP should be something that triggers on and off automatically rather than relying on Congress for discretionary stimulus in the future. And the other thing I'll note about the options we propose in the paper, we do look at how they would have worked during previous recessions, and they look pretty good to us, but again, they're somewhat arbitrary and would be interested if others have ideas about how those should work. So that's the first set of our recommendations. In UI and SNAP, we also have proposals that we believe would enhance their countercyclical properties. The other thing that I want to talk about is what we can do outside of automatic stabilizers. So the other thing that we think is true is that there is the possibility to either leverage existing architecture or build new architecture in certain programs such that when the next recession rolls around, if Congress wants to act, whatever actions they take can be more effective. And we talk about this in the paper in the context of both direct and subsidized job creation and housing assistance. And the one that I'm going to talk about is direct or subsidized job creation. What we propose in the paper is the creation of an employment fund. And what the employment fund would consist of is two components. One would be a subsidized jobs program, a flexible funding stream so that states could fund subsidized jobs programs. This is modeled after a program called the TANF Emergency Fund that was enacted during the last recession and worked pretty well. And the other aspect of the employment fund that we propose is something that a commission co-chaired by Larry Summers proposed last year, which is a set of fully funded national service jobs. They recommended about 500,000. And this employment fund would leverage both those fully funded national service jobs and a flexible funding stream for state subsidized employment programs on an ongoing basis. So this would be during normal economic times. The reason that we propose this is because these programs are difficult to ramp up from scratch immediately. And so even though the TANF Emergency Fund subsidized jobs program was effective during the last recession, We think it would have been more effective if it had had an infrastructure to build on already and could have gotten off the ground sooner. So our belief is, especially if we have this ongoing structure in place during normal economic times, when the next recession rolls around, Congress can do much more efficient stimulus through some subsidized job creation and some direct job creation. To bring it full circle again, I think we're all kind of in this place right now where if we were asked, are we ready for the next recession right now, the answer would be no. But the long answer we do think is really possible. And if we do strengthen our automatic stabilizers and build some architecture and other programs like we recommend in the paper, we really think that we will be ready for it when it gets here. So thank you very much.
Great. Thanks, everyone. Thanks very much. So I'll also talk about policies for the next recession. That'll be my focus. And I just want to start by applauding Ben and Jared. I've just taken a quick glance at their paper. So, on first glance, some of it I agree with, some of it I'll disagree with, but it seems like really important. I'm glad they're doing it. The hard work of saying what's the right thing to do and how to prepare. And the point that Ben made just at the end here about there's a good program having the infrastructure set up so it can ramp up. That seems really, really important. I'm also going to focus a bit on an important detail, which is the trigger off. And I kind of have the sense that sometimes the trigger on is a little bit easier. We're going to spend money, and the trigger off is not as easy. And I look at some of the programs that are temporary that don't end up being temporary. The next recession, obviously, some of the focus on policies for the next recession is driven by unhappiness over the current recovery. And, there's an obligatory joke here about recovery summer. But we all know the repeated false dawns and the sense in which even the current recovery is not super, is not super satisfactory. And I think that's implicit in the discussion of economic policy in the current presidential campaign, which I gather is going on. Implicit in some of the response that we've seen is that maybe we need more or maybe we need different. And it seems like the way to start that is by saying, well, why was the recovery weak? And one of the difficult things about this recession is that there are many factors behind it. So there wasn't just one thing to fix. And here I've listed some of them. The financial sector was impaired, and obviously policy, some of that I was involved in my time at the Treasury, helped to stabilize the financial sector. But then, of course, there were policy choices that kept the financial sector impaired and probably continue to keep it impaired in some ways. So that's been partially addressed, but not entirely. The debt overhang on consumers and businesses, which at least in the U.S., much of that has improved, but not entirely if you look at the Survey of Consumer Finances. And other data sources. And, of course, that's linked to inequality, that it could be for relatively high-income or high-wealth households. Their balance sheets are looking pretty good, and the other 80% of the households are not looking as good, and maybe they still feel the overhang. Implicit in many of these discussions that the fiscal stimulus was not big enough, and obviously I'm going to talk about, well, maybe it was big enough but not good enough, or the sort of quality was low. So I'm going to talk a little bit about fiscal quality. I think it's impossible to avoid, in some sense, the Rahm Emanuel point about don't let the crisis go to waste. And in some sense, that went counter to what would have been best for our economy. And obviously I understand from a political point of view wanting to kind of jam through things when there's 60 votes available to jam them through. But I suspect it went in the wrong direction. And here, I'm skipping a bullet. Here, I mean, the recovery is held back by policy choices, right? There's a sense in which we're layering on disruptive change in the middle of recession. And so, without going into that, was ACA a good thing or a bad thing? And, I can go into all the arguments there. Dodd-Frank, the regulatory surge, uncertainty about the rule of law in various situations. It's a lot of stress on the economy. It's a lot of disruptive change. And so it seems like layering that on to a recovery is inevitably going to impair the recovery. And then skipping back to my fourth bullet, right, of course, at the same time, many people would say, that the political system was disruptive to the recovery. Now, of course, we know today financial markets and maybe TV audiences know to kind of tune out the political show. You know, we're not going to default on the debt and things like that. But of course, back in 2011, maybe people didn't quite get that. So I do understand the idea that that there's been political disruptions and that's interrupted the recovery. You know, it's kind of tough to say, okay, well, let's fix the political system. It's not a great policy recommendation. On the other hand, there are times when things worked. And that's, you know, to me, I look at things that worked, right? On student loans, for example, right? President Obama and Congress worked very well together. The Medicare doc fix, what I call the Obama-Bush tax cuts were extended in full and then mostly made permanent. So there are times when the political system has not held back growth. And then lastly, I think there's still an open question about, is the recovery weak or do we just have a diminished growth trajectory? And I'm going to return to that at the very end when I talk about my conclusions. Okay, so let me talk briefly about the fiscal response. And this is a little bit of a catalog of what we've done in addressing the last recession. And then I'll use that to think about the next one. And I start from the premise that it's helpful, but not, you know, sort of not the end of the discussion to address the proximate cause of the recession. But of course, it's not always possible to do that. And I think my first bullet is exactly that, right? The housing sector in 2007, 2008 was obviously the you know, an important source of the financial crisis and the Great Recession. When I was at the Treasury, the administration in some sense made the choice to do some on housing, but really to focus on the broad economy, to say the housing market has to adjust and will adjust, and instead policy is going to address the broad economy. And so there's a fiscal stimulus in early 2008. It was, quote, only $150 billion, which seems like a whole lot at the time. And there's a lot of evidence, I would say, suggesting that was pretty effective. But we didn't, in a sense, we didn't wash away the problems in housing, and those continue to weigh on the economy. There's the banks and the broader financial sector response in 2008, 2009. And my point there is that the response was very politically difficult, but actually very effective and very cost-effective, right? And so, of course, the TARP was a large amount of money, but in terms of the net cost actually turned out to be, you know, relatively small, and depending on how you count it, whether it's plus or minus. And then the stress tests that were put in by Treasury Secretary Geithner and the Fed were incredibly effective, right, and incredibly cost-effective, and I would say continue to be cost-effective. And so those two things together, since this went directly to the part of the source of the problem driving the economy down. And then there are other things. There are the targeted fiscal support, infrastructure, and other spending that I think is in vogue now that I'll talk about next. And then the automatic stabilizers we heard, and monetary policy, which will be on the next panel. I'm not going to talk about it. Okay, so I think there is broad agreement among Americans that infrastructure spending should be part of the next fiscal response, and Americans want that to be in the form of a wall. So I'm not sure that is the highest quality infrastructure spending, but I think there is that agreement. So President Obama can take credit for that consensus in our society. So I think it is important, actually, in a discussion of infrastructure, which should be part of the response to the next recession, to think about the quality of fiscal stimulus. And here, you know, my joke is that if you talk to administration staffers about my three bullets, it says they turn into teenagers and their eyes start rolling, right? Anyone with teenagers knows that phenomenon, and they understand that the administration position on high-speed rail and you know, sort of the green pork and Keystone is just preposterous, right? It's sort of, you know, they don't even bother. You can't have a conversation. But to me, that's the problem, is that it's hard to have a discussion about infrastructure until we agree not to just burn taxpayer resources, right? And just a few weeks ago, right, the administration had another proposal to have a gas tax, and they take the revenue and just burn it, as far as I can tell, burn it, right? And I know that because the first words I saw were high-speed rail, right? And that's a synonym for burning taxpayer resources, as far as I can tell. Obviously, the Northeast Corridor is probably not burning taxpayer resources, but it's also not high-speed rail. So to me, that's the real key is having high-quality fiscal stimulus. Romer and Romer did a paper analyzing the Sanders plan, and they downplay the impact of infrastructure spending for long-term growth, but they still see some benefit for it in the medium term. Okay, so that's still there. Okay, so when you think about policies and fiscal room, I'm going to skip ahead a little bit just in the interest of time. So my answer is yes. I think there is fiscal room to do a new stimulus spending. So if there's a recession soon, I think we could do it. Before then, I think it'd be very useful to prepare for the next downturn. And the things I have in mind there are exactly the kind of work that Jared and Ben are doing, is to say what works and do more of the good and less of the bad. And especially I'd focus on less of the bad. Think about what didn't work and let's do less of it. And then have a growth agenda to say there are things we can do to improve our growth trajectory. And I think that's really the agenda for the next president, whoever that should be. Let me stop there.
Thanks. So thank you all for trying so hard to stick to the time, even though Philip made you skip over 2/3 of your slides. I want to pick up, though, on one thing you said at the end and ask Wendy and Ben about this. So there is a view out there that we don't have the fiscal space. That is that debt is so high that if we had a recession soon, that we wouldn't be able to borrow money to fund whether they were automatic stabilizers or discretionary fiscal policy. How do we even think about that? Do we know? And what are the arguments on one side or the other?
I think this gets back a little bit to our interpretation of the literature, which is there's no particular trigger. So we know that lower debt is better than higher debt, and we know that a flatter trajectory of debt is better than a steeper trajectory of debt. So we can make those qualitative statements, but it's hard to know when investors might lose confidence. But one thing I will say is that it should be true that investors should care not just about levels but about trajectories. So a fiscal response to economic weakness that credibly only temporarily raises deficits and debt and comes coupled with some sort of long-term response, or maybe even actually gets layered on top of a longer-term fiscal agenda that stabilizes debt to GDP, should have very different implications than implementing policies that make debt to GDP steeper than it is under current law.
Right, but so I think there are many economists who would say it would be ideal if we had short-term stimulus and long-term deficit reduction, and so far none of them have been elected to Congress.
But we can continue to say it.
Good hope. Ben, how do you think about, do you worry at all about having too much debt?
So I think our perspective is we like to think of ourselves as cyclical doves, structural hawks. So definitely agree that all else equal, we want a declining debt to GDP ratio. But our view is that all else isn't equal, and especially that's the case during recessions. So we think that when you're thinking about the automatic stabilizers and the types of recommendations we're making in the paper, we really need to weigh what are the benefits of doing these things against the potential drawbacks of higher debt to GDP. And we really think that the benefits far outweigh the potential drawbacks. Louise came out with a paper recently, actually, where they examined the long-term fiscal outlook and our fiscal space, and I think agreed that that automatic stabilizers are a place where we should definitely be bolstering what we currently do.
Right. And Phil, is it your point that you're cool with bigger automatic stabilizers, but you're not so cool about discretionary fiscal policy because, in general, discretionary fiscal policy hasn't been very well designed?
I mean, it's a mix, right? I'm cool, I guess is the word you used.
Be sure you tell your teenagers.
Yeah, exactly,
cool.
Exactly. Yeah, three of them.
Don't tell them that I'm older than you are.
Exactly. I look at the discretionary fiscal policy of the last two recessions, and it actually worked reasonably well. I mean, I look at the 2008 fiscal stimulus, so I accidentally almost implied something good about Ara, so I take that back.
I was noticing that. I was a little worried here.
So I really think of there's a literature suggesting Ara was effective in some ways. It probably wasn't as effective as it could have been. But the 2008 stimulus was in some ways remarkable about how quickly it was agreed upon and then how quickly it got out into the economy, which presents itself as a contrast with the 2009 stimulus. So I'm not against discretionary fiscal policy. I think there is an important role for Congress. And in some sense, we want Congress to own that, right? We want Congress to be responsive. At the same time, I do agree with them, the authors of the paper, that there's a role for better stable.
Is your point about 2008, the George Bush stimulus and the Barack Obama stimulus, that it's okay if it's tax cuts, but it's not okay if it's spending?
No. The Ara was a mix, right? I mean, they had some tax cuts. They had some, that went in wage, essentially wage packets. The Bush one was more heavily on the tax side. The spending part, I think there is a role for spending. And when I was thinking about what you said about the long term, and that to me, that's exactly it. That spending on preschool, for example, right? There's lots of evidence that that'd be a really important thing, and you want to get it right. Whereas like spending on increasing Social Security benefits for high earners, right, which is part of Senator Sanders' plan, to me, that it's hard to explain why you'd want to do that.
But one thing I don't understand is you said it seemed like a nice thing to say that it's easier to trigger it on than trigger it off, but I thought there was a critique of what fiscal policy in the last 5 years had been that was just the opposite, that the Obama stimulus passed pretty quickly. Some of it got out quickly, some of it didn't, but it triggered off too soon.
No, okay, you so what I didn't have a chance to talk about, and it's a little bit in the paper, and it's probably one of my points of disagreement with the paper, is unemployment insurance, right? There's a debate about ending extended UI, right? There's some evidence from papers of the New York Fed and other places about what people call the North Carolina question. And, so set that aside, whether, ending extended UI was the right thing or not, the administration said the world will end if we don't extend UI. We didn't extend UI, right? I mean, the world didn't end. The recovery proceeded. So I think there's a lot of questions about some of these automatic stabilizers.
But wait, but I'm going to isn't the evidence of the last couple of years that we turned them off and that some people think that was a mistake?
Well, no,
we had the sequester, the ARRA stuff ran down, things expired. I mean, I thought this was a case study in you can have temporary fiscal stimulus. It was temporary, maybe too temporary.
No, I mean, I would look at what is the automatic part, right? To me, that's the question. That's why UI is the example, is how do we have something that is pre-programmed automatic? How do we have it actually end? Right, the sequester and things like that. Right, there's obviously lots of discussion about the political dynamics relating to the pattern of spending, and we clearly didn't have the optimal pattern. But I don't think that says therefore we should have more spending or less spending. It says if you could take out the political drama, and say what spending should we have had or. To me, it's an important discussion, but I don't know. It doesn't seem indicative of.
When you think about the automatic stabilizer part, how do you think about the trigger off part? Why is that important, and what confidence do you have that the politicians will let it trigger off?
Well, so we try to be clear in the paper that our conversation about the triggers on and off are abstracted away from a discussion of what's benefit adequacy during normal times, because I think that's a whole separate conversation, but. We definitely do think that if you're talking about programs that are supposed to be countercyclical stimulus, they should have the on and the off trigger. I tend to agree much more with you that during this past recession, we saw things trigger off too soon. I think if we want to talk about, for example, unemployment insurance compensation, which was discretionary stimulus that Congress passed, did end at the end of 2013. And we would contend that there's still remaining slack in the labor market, and it could have gone on longer. The proposal that we have in the paper, actually, for enhancing the automatic stabilization capability of the unemployment insurance system is to incorporate new tiers where additional unemployment benefits would trigger on, which would obviate some of the need for Congress to do the discretionary stimulus on an ad hoc basis. So to some extent, I think that our proposal would solve some of the concern that Phil's worried about because it would have an automatic way of triggering on and triggering it off when it hits these tiers.
Okay, and you want to respond
to that? No, I was just going to say, I haven't had a chance to read the paper carefully, just beyond a skim, but to me it'll be interesting to see, do you treat this literature seriously, right? I mean, what's the optimal duration? And there is this sort of argument by respectable researchers back and forth. The other thing I was just thinking of, you remember during the gigantic snowstorm, there's the D.C. school system, right, opened some of the schools and had school meals. To me, that seems like that is really high-quality spending, and that's the kind of thing in other words, I'm trying to say I'm not against all spending. But,
okay.
That's clear.
Wendy, ahead and respond, then I want to
So I showed this graph of what deficits with automatic stabilizers and deficits without automatic stabilizers looked like between 2008 and 2015. And you can see that deficits without automatic stabilizers shrunk a lot more quickly than deficits with automatic stabilizers, which is to say that the automatic stabilizer portion of fiscal policy was continuing to do more to stimulate the economy than active fiscal policy.
Okay.
I shouldn't have said more. I don't mean those in rank order, but
even when they cut back on discretionary fiscal policy,
automatic stabilizers were continuing on.
Right. Yeah. Right. So I think some of this has to do with how much do we want to ask Congress to tie your hands so you do what you do in advance, and how much do we trust you to do the right thing. The moment, not very much, but that might not be a permanent condition. Wendy, one final question. So a lot of the discussion we've had here could have been said when interest rates were at 4% or at 7%, but now interest rates are bumping along at zero, and there's reason to believe they will be close to zero for some time. How does that change our thinking about the role that fiscal stimulus plays in a recession, both the automatic kind and the discretionary kind?
So I think to the extent that monetary policymakers are constrained, it has some of the same implications that we've talked about in terms of fiscal room with whether or not we think that fiscal policymakers are constrained. To the extent that policymakers are constrained in their ability to respond to economic challenges, that's going to make the cost of those economic challenges deeper, both for the economy and for well-being. So that's true on the monetary policy side. It's true on the fiscal policy side. So yes, the fact that interest rates even though we project that interest rates will come up notably from their current low levels, we still project that interest rates, even in the long term, will be lower than they have been. They will be lower in the projection than they have been in recent decades. So to the degree that represents that suggests that monetary policy might be more constrained in the future, that's now you have not just one problem but two.
Okay. Let me, we'll come back, you guys come back, why don't you step down, and we're starting with Rich or John? Rich, okay. So now we're going to turn to monetary policy, and the two speakers are Rich Clarida, who also is a veteran of the Bush Treasury, currently at Columbia and at PIMCO, and he'll be followed by John Faust, who is a recent veteran of the Bernanke, Yellen, Fed, and is now at Johns Hopkins. I'll come back after they finish, have a little conversation, and then Louise will come up here and have a conversation with everybody all at once.
All right, well, thank you very much, and it's a real treat to be here. It's my first visit to the Hutchins Center, although you've got a great web presence, and I follow what you do here actively. The assignment is to talk about are we ready for the next recession from the point of view of monetary policy. Let me begin by saying I don't think the next recession is imminent, but it's certainly worth thinking through the options. And I think in particular the discussion regarding monetary policy is especially interesting these days. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about where we are now vis-a-vis monetary policy, and then talk about how that impacts, either constrains or provide insights into what we might see in the next downturn. So traditionally, before the crisis, monetary policy was about raising or lowering interest rates. We all got very comfortable with that model. And of course, since the crisis, when we hit the zero lower bound in December of 2008 in the U.S., the Fed had to pursue, out of necessity, different measures. And the primary unconventional or new measures the Fed pursued were various forms of quantitative easing and more sophisticated and precise forms of forward guidance. So to start off with some historical data, quantitative easing, we're all familiar, is purchasing large quantities of government bonds. But unfortunately, I think the term quantitative easing has always been a bit misleading, because what's been important about QE is not the size so much, but what the Fed has been buying. And it's been buying a lot of mortgage-backed securities, and it's been buying a lot of long-duration or long-maturity treasuries. And I'm certainly in the camp that believes that, although there's some academic debate perhaps, that I think the QE programs as implemented by the Fed have worked, because they have taken interest rate risk out of the market and have taken the risk embedded in mortgage securities in the market. I think that perspective is important, because if you try to look at quantitative easing through the traditional Milton Friedman MV equals PY lens, it's very confusing, because the balance sheet has expanded. This is the growth in the balance sheet in orange, but there have been more or less offsetting reductions in the money multiplier. We know there are excess reserves in the banking system. And so the impact of QE has not been through generating inflation directly, but by changing asset prices in a way to be supportive of the economy. And I'll come back in a moment as to the attractiveness and the feasibility of doing more QE in the next downturn. Here's a snapshot that I had an assistant put together. This is essentially the maturity profile of the Fed's balance sheet under a scenario where at some point they passively let the portfolio run off. You can pick your favorite date. Until the date on the horizontal axis, the Fed is committed to reinvesting those proceeds as those securities mature. Now, mortgages are tricky, because mortgages nominally last for 30 years, but most people pay off their mortgage, or on average mortgage is outstanding for about 7 years. So you have to make assumptions about the maturity or the payoff on mortgages. But the impact here, the message of this slide, is simply that because of the size and the scope of the QE program, it's going to take some time, even in the absence of the next recession, for the Fed's balance sheet to normalize. And importantly, as I'm sure John will remind us, the normal size for the Fed balance sheet is a lot larger than it was in 2007 because of the growth in the demand for currency, which, if anything, has been growing more rapidly. So even if the Fed gets back to a normal balance sheet, it's going to be bigger than it was in 2007 or 8. Now, another key fact of life that the Yellen Fed has been reminding us of is this notion that the liftoff for Fed rates, and again, David's chart showed you with a microscope, you can see that 25 basis point increase in December, but there is a liftoff path, and I'll come back to that in a moment. And one reason why we have a very gradual liftoff path, as communicated by Chair Yellen and others, is this notion that the equilibrium, or as I've called it, the neutral real interest rate in the economy, is lower than before the crisis. Now, the neutral interest rate is an important input to monetary policy. It's also unobserved, and it's also time-varying, which, as John Faust, as the world's leading expert, can tell you, means it's a really hard thing to nail down econometrically. But the best guess that we have is that neutral policy rates in the U.S. and around the world are a lot lower than they used to be, which means that the ultimate Fed destination in this cycle is lower. Now, a corollary of that is that even when you get to that destination, rates are going to be a lot lower than they were before the crisis, which means that any adverse shock is more likely to put you into a situation where the central bank will have to use unconventional tools. The rule of thumb in the famous John Taylor rule was to aim for a policy rate of 2% inflation plus John's assumption of a 2% neutral rate. So you'd have rates of around 4%. Indeed, on average, from 1994 until 2007, that was the average funds rate in that period. And in a new neutral world, because the destination is lower, you're more likely to need to use unconventional policies. Another striking thing that's worth following is the evolution in the way financial markets think about the destination for Fed policy. So what I've plotted here is the evolving view about short-term interest rates in the U.S. at a particular point in the future, December 2018. And this contract has been traded in the futures markets for a long time. And what's striking about this, and again, you have to make corrections for things like liquidity and term premium, but this gives you a first cut at evolving market views of where the ultimate destination is for Fed policy. And what's striking is, if you go back into those dark days of 08 and 09, and even after the taper tantrum in 2013, folks thought the Fed was going to get rates up more or less to where they had before the crisis, roughly 2% inflation plus 2% real. And you see those expectations have been trailing down pretty substantially to the point that there's a pretty big gulf between the Fed's blue dot exercise, which we can discuss during Q&A if you wish, and market pricing. Part of this is, of course, simply the fact that market pricing has to factor in not only the most likely scenario for the economy, but the tail risk of not getting to neutral, and it's slightly different from the dots. But the reality is that the markets have certainly are very much in this view of a gradual liftoff. Now, just a little bit on economic theory. You probably remember from a macro course that you took in college that there's a rule of thumb that relates real interest rates to growth rates. And if you look at the underlying math, there's a lot of slippage there. I'm just trying to get an equation from one of my papers. But the key point is that even if you're in a world where the only thing that drives real rates is growth, modern macro models say it's really the global growth rate, not any one country's growth rate, because we have an integrated capital market. So even if we haven't changed our view of the U.S. growth outlook, if global growth slows, we'd expect that to have an impact on rates. And so I think that needs to be regarded as well. Yet another reason why we're more likely to see the Fed needing to use unconventional tools in the next downturn. This is a chart which I keep putting in because it attracts a lot of attention. So I typed into Google a chart illustrating the complexity of Middle East geopolitics. And this is the first thing that popped up, and I love it. I had occasion to have a conversation with Daniel Yergin about a year ago, and I showed him this chart, and I said, you know, what do you make of this? He said, looks about right. So, and of course, he knows a lot more than I do. So the key point here is not to get into our views of alliances or conflicts in the Middle East, but merely to say that even though so far we haven't seen any huge repercussions, there is a lot more risk geopolitically in the world, potentially. And Ken Rogoff, who you all know quite well, had a nice piece recently making what is a very basic but fundamentally important point, which is that even a small increase in investor sentiment about extreme outcomes can lead to very big repricing of safe sovereign bonds in a world where there's a desire to hold those assets as an insurance premium against adverse outcomes. And so just to give you an example of this, what I plot is the total realized return to someone who on January 1st, 2008, had bought a 30-year treasury bond. Don't do anything fancy, lever it up, or do any options. You just buy the bond and go to sleep. And even though bonds are boring, at the end of the year, your total return would have been up about 40%. And so so sovereign bonds of a handful of countries, think Germany, think the U.S., do provide that premium. And so in addition to the other factors, slower growth and neutral and the like, there is this desire for these assets. And, of course, given that many other central banks in the world have gone to negative rates, there's yet an even another reason, and this gets to the fiscal discussion about the profile for U.S. Rates. I've given various examples here of forward guidance. There was a recent conference in New York discussing forward guidance as a tool, and it's important to remember that in a lot of our textbook models, forward guidance shouldn't have any impact. But in the real world, it tends to for a couple of reasons. One is that it gives us some insights into the central bank's reaction function. And number two, depending upon how you formulate the guidance, in particular the calendar date-based guidance, which began under Greenspan and was extended under Bernanke, can have a very powerful effect on market expectations. So forward guidance is one of those things that in theory shouldn't work, but in practice, if it's appropriately communicated, I think can work. So just a couple more slides to finish up. Obviously, we know that we've gone through a big severe crisis and a very sluggish recovery, but it's also true, and these are CBO estimates of potential output. So another factor that makes the Fed's life either interesting or complicated, depending upon your choice of adjectives, is the fact that even though because of oil prices and recovery, inflation's been below the Fed's target, we are getting to the point where the traditional output gap measures are closing, which creates an interesting problem for the Fed if there's perhaps more inflation down the road than currently expected. And then finally, a little bit on options for the Fed. I put a question mark here. Is it time for a price level target? And just the quick distinction, for a central bank that's pursuing a price level targeting strategy as opposed to inflation targeting, when they fall below the inflation target of 2%, they actually seek to overshoot in order to average inflation at 2%. Now, Chair Yellen recently, including last week, has indicated that she herself is not embracing a formal Mike Woodford-style price level target. But she's also indicated that she'd like the 2% inflation target to be symmetric, and we have been undershooting. So let me then conclude with a couple of observations about what I think would be in the Fed toolkit. And luckily, it's a lot easier to do with confidence because Chair Yellen was asked this question last week by a Bloomberg reporter, in particular in the context of whether or not we would see negative policy rates out of the Fed in the next downturn. And essentially, as I read her answer, she indicated that the Fed options would include various forms of forward guidance, maturity extension, which is essentially a version of quantitative easing but without ballooning the balance sheet, and then quantitative easing. And she certainly seemed to indicate that, that negative rates, perhaps because of the experience of other countries, are not at the top of their list. I would also point out another factor that central banks have at their disposal, which the Fed did not use in the last downturn, but certainly in principle could be deployed, is an explicit program that would essentially try to cap the yield on government bonds with essentially through substantial intervention. And you might think the Fed did everything and the kitchen sink, but in the last crisis it didn't explicitly peg the ceiling yield on government bonds. So I think I will stop there and look forward to John's comments. Thank you very much.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here to talk about this somewhat ominous question. Rich is much more prepared, more quickly prepared than I am, and sent his slides a long time ago, so I actually had an opportunity to make my talk dovetail with his a little bit, and so the issues have been set up very nicely. But I think there's a few ways we could think about this question. Is the Fed ready for recession? Now we've directed it at the Fed, not we. And there's a lot of ways you can think about that. Is it aware of the risks? Is the Fed prepared to do what it can? Would the Fed's response be powerful and effective? So we've got yes, and at best, modestly so, is the answers. And I think that's kind of what the answer was about fiscal policy as well. I want to embellish that. But first, let me say one of the reasons why I think it would be modestly so is that when I was I spent a few years as special advisor to the Federal Reserve Board and was there when the aforementioned fiscal cliff event happened. There's a lot of discussion about whether a recession might come, and the chair, that was Bernanke at the time, was regularly asked, so what could you do? Would you be able to respond if there's a recession? And he said, no. That the tools in place at that time didn't probably weren't enough to completely offset such an event. So the question is, why? What do we think? Things could be better now or worse now. A few years have gone past, and I think the answer is probably the economy's healthier, so it'd certainly be less scary. But as far as the tools are concerned, it's about the same, or perhaps even they're weaker. So let me go through that. We can go through various kinds of tools, the ones that Chair Yellen was asked about in the press conference. I'm going to divide them into things the Fed tried, things the Fed didn't try, and things folks talk about but probably aren't legal. And the last is various forms of helicopter drops, which get talked about a lot. So let me talk about things that were tried. Forward guidance. Now, forward guidance, you tell folks what's going to happen. There's a misconception about, oftentimes the distinction isn't drawn between two forms of forward guidance. I'm going to call one prescriptive. And the idea here is that somehow the current FOMC dictates policy to future FOMCs. In fact, dictates that they will follow a policy that they're not going to want to follow. This goes in the not try discussion. No central bank in the world has tried this. So when we get to not try it, I'll discuss it, but not now. Things they have tried, well, they did forward guidance, but it's what I might call information-only forward guidance. An example would be the famous thresholds that the Fed announced. They said we're going to keep interest rates at zero as long as the unemployment rate is above 6.5% and inflation remains well-behaved. That's a paraphrase of a longer statement. There's an underappreciated fact here that information-only forward guidance, that's going to add accommodation only at times when the public misunderstands what the Fed's intentions are. When the public understands how accommodative the Fed intends to be, telling folks what you're going to do doesn't do anything. Now, as we saw in Rich's picture, interest rates declined fairly steadily from and still remained high relative to today, even in 2012 and 2013. There was still room for the Fed to say, no, you don't get it yet. We intend to be really accommodative. It's not clear that room is still there. In fact, anybody who's checked recently will realize that market measures of expected policy suggest that the market or the market's derived expectations are actually that the Fed will be more accommodative than it claims it's going to be. So if you did forward guidance right now or you followed what the Fed is saying, it would actually represent a tightening. So forward guidance still works. Forward guidance is just clarity about what you're going to do, the information-only forward guidance. Clarity is a great thing. The Fed should do that. But it's not going to have the oomph that it did when we were brand new at all this and folks just didn't get it. And so the Fed would announce something and people would go, oh, I see, they're really serious about this. That had an oomph. Next time around, there won't be as much of that unless the market has really changed its opinion. So next, there's large-scale asset purchases, what people call QE. The Fed calls it large-scale asset purchases for the reason that Rich pointed out that QE is kind of a misnomer or misleading. So the idea here is that you go out and you buy a bunch of long-term bonds. You've increased the demand for those. That pushes up their price, which is the same thing as driving down their yields. So you drive down the yields on long-term securities, hopefully then that stimulates the economy. So you can ask, is there still capacity to do that? And there's various ways you could look at the capacity question. You could say, is there still a quantity of stuff to buy? There's only so many mortgage-backed securities out there. There's only so many government securities out there. So there are limits there, but there's still plenty of capacity in that sense. But in another sense, it's not clear that the capacity is quite as large, and it's the same point about interest rates that we've been talking about. So QE2, the famous QE2 program was adopted at the end of 2010. Rates were around 3.5. Then a sequence of programs, including the maturity extension program and QE3 and QE, or some people call it QE infinity, those were adopted in rapid succession and pushed rates down to about 1.5, where they stayed until the Fed said it was time to start normalizing things. So there was nearly 200 basis points, 2 full percentage points of easing in long-term rates, but we're starting out now at a different point.
Stay with the mic.
Yeah, I will. I'm going back. We're starting at a different point. There's not so much room to lower long-term rates as there was back in 2012 or 2010 when QE2 was adopted. Now, it still may be useful to push those rates negative, but that's a much more ambiguous question. Most folks think going from 3.5 to 2.5 is a good thing. Going from 50 basis points to minus 50, that gets a little more ambiguous. Not as much room. So on the things tried, still useful, arguably a bit less potential than before. So you could still provide some support for the economy. Things not tried, well, there's that prescriptive forward guidance, and that's where you promise to deliver an inflationary boom in the future when interest rates are no longer zero. So a few years down the road, you say, once I get the power to do so, I'm going to produce an inflationary boom. And the idea is that households and businesses, anticipating future good times, spend more today, because that's what economists say you do. If there's going to be good times in the future, you you start doing more today. So why didn't anybody use it? No central, every academic paper says that's the right thing. No central bank tried it anywhere in the world. Well, it requires the private sector to overextend itself today, having faith that the, that party is going to happen in the future. Central banks announced that in their explanation for why they didn't do that, the ECB, the Fed, the Bank of England have all said they had lots of reasons to be dubious about this. For the Fed, one key reason to be dubious about it is that the current FOMC can't dictate future policy. We could have a chair turnover soon. We could have a chair turnover with a administration turnover. You know, we could think about promising to deliver a party 2 years from now, but Rand Paul is chair at that moment. The point is that there's no legal way, and there's perhaps no credible way to promise that several years in the future this boom will happen. Still worth a try? If things get bad enough, sure, maybe. So close cousins to this are price level targeting, nominal GDP targeting, raising the inflation target. The immediate effect of all those is to cause this inflationary boom at the current moment. If it's not credible, it's not credible. So these might be fine on average in the long term, in the fullness of time, maybe it'd be the right thing. But would it have the immediate benefit today that we're looking for? Perhaps, but it's no more likely than the prescriptive forward guidance to do so. Not right here, negative rates. On the table, but not favored. I don't want to say more about that. It's a long discussion, and I'll say about what Rich did. On the table, Chair Yellen said, not going to be done. Finally, there's helicopter drops. You know, Peter Pratt said all central banks can do it. You can issue currency, distribute it to people. The question is, you know, when it's opportune to do that. As it turns out, central banks have mandates. Most couldn't legally give away cash, as it turns out, so it's got to go some other way. So maybe there's stealth helicopter drops. So there's various ways that could happen, I suppose. But my main point about helicopter drops is that for the Fed, the Fed's mandate is really narrow and much more precise than many central banks. So you're going to have to check with the lawyers first before you think that some kind of helicopter drop is going to work. Lots of Fed legislation, both about fees, about interest rates, and other legislation, have the clear intent of having the Fed operate at market prices and avoid any implicit or explicit subsidies to the banking system. And so all of these ways that are that start to look like helicopter drops are dubious under the Fed's mandate. You know, maybe folks can figure it out, maybe they can't. Bottom line, not out of ammunition, can still provide meaningful support. But that's modest support. You might try some of the stuff that's not been tried yet, but there's a reason it hasn't been tried yet, because folks didn't think it was going to be as good as what they were doing. Okay.
So I think we should go right to the panel, because we're a little behind. So take a seat. Louise's going to sit at the end there, and you can sit here. I just want to mention while people are coming up that Jared Bernstein of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, Ben Spielberg's co-author, is going to take his place, so you get the benefit of two tall people from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. I want to mention also that on June 6th here at the Hutchins Center, we're going to have a discussion about negative interest rates, which has been mentioned, particularly focus on what we've learned from the European experience. We have a number of people from European central banks that have been doing this, and now it's no longer theoretical. And I also want to call your attention to Ben Bernanke, who wrote a blog that posted last week where he took a view slightly different than the one that Janet Yellen took. He suggested that negative interest rates might be worth trying before the Fed tries another round of QE. And he has at length in a blog post that he wrote with our research assistant, Peter Olson, explained that. So here's the deal, Louise. You have the conversation.
Yeah.
And if I feel you don't ask the right question, when we get to the Q&A, I'll ask it.
right. Great, thanks. So we have both fiscal people and monetary policy people here. So let me ask a question. Before the Great Recession, the conventional wisdom was that we shouldn't use fiscal policy to help with cyclical problems. We should use monetary policy. Now it seems like the conventional wisdom has moved around, that we probably should use a combination and that fiscal policy is more important. Is that because we learned something about how effective fiscal policy is, or is that because we're at the zero lower bound? And anybody answer? Jared, why don't you start?
Okay. Let's see if my voice still works. Thank you, everybody. It's great to have such a great crowd here, and everybody's hung around. Thank you. It's a compelling topic. I think it's because of the ZLB, because of the zero lower bound. I don't think it's that complicated. I think when the Federal Reserve has more ammunition, then certainly a combination is relevant. I always thought Ben Bernanke made a lot of sense when he went to Congress regularly during the initial part of what I can, you know, the quite weak recovery. Was initially quite jobless back in 2010, 2011, and he was constantly saying, we're doing all we can, we need a fiscal help from Congress. And in fact, when you're at the zero lower bound, the fiscal multiplier is larger and more potent. So I think that makes why we're in the world we're in.
And Ben reiterated that in his blog post that David just advertised, that what we need now is a mix because the monetary tools are so weak.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to mention, I agree. I think we've also learned it can be effective, right? I mean, they had the 2008, and I mean, David called it the Bush, but I call it the Bush-Pelosi stimulus that they agreed to it very quickly. And it got, you know, the IRS did amazing work in getting it out the door. So lots of people who made it effective.
So we think it's not as doesn't have such a lag as we used to think.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
Also that we might need it more. So if we think that interest rates are going to be low and we're going to be more likely to be hit by the zero lower bound, John, you said that it didn't make sense, that there was no immediate impact of trying to raise the inflation target. But now we're looking forward. We're saying, well, what if we're in an era where we think that the probability of hitting the zero lower bound is a lot higher than we thought before? What kind of arguments would push you to say it's time to raise the inflation target, or is it not? Is it something that should be on the table for sort of looking forward?
Yes, I think it definitely should be. The 2% was chosen explicitly to balance the risks of high inflation is costly, but low inflation has you hit the zero bound too often. We've learned more that we were more likely to hit it than we thought, and we've learned that it's trickier to get out of than we thought. Both of those say you should at least redo that computation, the same one you did, update it, and see if it still says 2%. I think that's undeniable.
But just riffing off of John's what I thought was a great presentation, suppose they said 3. I thought the implied in your presentation was no one would really take them that seriously. They wouldn't be able to get
whether you could hit that on average over time, that over the next 50 years, if that's going to be our policy, could you achieve it? Mm-hmm. Yes. Right now, would that help? Would people immediately expect 3, and would that then provide the stimulus to get us out of where we're at? That's what we're dubious about.
Yep.
Rich, do you agree? Or?
Yeah, I think it's a practical matter. I think it's unlikely to see a formal elevation of inflation targets to 3 or Olivier Blanchard's 4, but I do think over the next 3 to 5 years, central banks being more receptive to some version of averaging inflation, probably not go all the way to a Woodford price level target, but could I see a central banker saying, for the last 5 years, inflation's been 1.7, so we're not unhappy if for the next 5 years it's 2.3? I think we could see that.
Yeah. I mean, the arguments that inflation's getting out of control is just, you know, we're on the verge of out of control inflation. That just hasn't panned out, so...
So we've talked about what we're state fiscal and monetary policy are in for the next recession, maybe what economists have learned. Are our politics ready for the next recession? And what do you think that the political lessons have been learned at the state level, by people, by Congress, and how does that impair our ability to fight the next recession?
Wendy?
That's not fair, exactly. I could say, I mean, I just, again, I have to go back to my, you know, my time at the Treasury. In 2008, right, the beginning of 2008 seems like an inauspicious time to rapidly do fiscal policy, right? I mean, the Iraq debate and, you know, it wasn't like the administration and Congress that, you know, Democratic-controlled Congress got along super well. in 06, 07. But in some ways, that made the 2008 stimulus easier because both sides had an incentive to get something done. And so, you know, the Congress said, look, we're not insisting on our kind of tax, on our kind of stimulus. And President Bush said, look, I'm not insisting on permanent tax cuts. Let's just get it done. And so, you know, there is a sense which that kind of fractiousness can lead to moments of, you know, of cooperation.
I mean, one definition of a Keynesian is a Republican in a recession.
We actually had that discussion in 2002 and 2003, and Jared's absolutely right. So, yeah, absolutely right.
That said, it would be, I think, one of the motivations that Ben underscored was that to the extent that we can do more on the automatic side, we take away from this discretionary lag that is a legitimate concern right now.
And how about at the states? Was there some concern that in the last recession there was like money left on the table by the states that maybe going through the states to try to stimulate the economy is going to become less effective because of what's happened to the politics at the state level? I mean, there were a few examples where there was, or the Medicaid expansions, where there was money, federal money on the table that was just not taken up.
Yeah, I think there was some of that. But if you kind of go down the list of multipliers, and by this I mean which was most effective in terms of getting bang for the buck, state fiscal relief score is very high. And this isn't just the kind of this comes from not just the modeling work, the type that CBO or Zandi and Blinder did, but also some pretty careful empirical work about how state fiscal relief played. And I would suggest that it was, you know, very effective in large part because of the balanced budget requirement that Ben noted. To the extent that there was some money left on the table, that doesn't strike me as that doesn't dissuade me from our recommendations.
I mean, there's some argument that states use the money to boost their rainy day funds, but the hard thing to know is what the counterfactual is. Like, money's fungible. So if states were actually looking to boost their rainy day funds because they were very worried about their fiscal outlook, it's quite possible they would have done that anyway.
Mm-hmm. So there's some people who argue that since we're worried about the next recession, we don't have fiscal space, we don't have monetary space, that we should take the opportunity now to create some by being more aggressive on lowering the debt and maybe even by raising interest rates a bit faster than we otherwise might so that we'd have space of something, you know, something.
I'll take the monetary. I never understood that argument. I never understood the argument that in order to give myself more room to cut, I want to increase the odds of the next recession. Now, but in fairness to those who are making that case, if you are in a world where you think you want to end up at 4 or 5% on the funds rate, then why not get there? But I think the important point that the Yellen Fed has conveyed through recent communication is they're rationalizing their gradual liftoff not by saying we want to be behind the curve for the next 3 years. They're actually saying is that's what the economy can take. So I think that reinforces the view that raising rates rapidly to a high level so you can cut them is not a winning proposition.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. If I can make a quick comment on fiscal space, I think there are three opinions about fiscal space. The first one says debt to GDP is just too high. We shouldn't do anything. Those folks, I think, are very out of tune with the kinds of evidence that we've talked today. And I think there's a lot of bipartisan sentiment that you heard today to no small extent that fits in the other two camps. The next camp says we don't, yes, 75% of GDP is a high debt to GDP ratio, but it shouldn't stop us from what we need to do. We should just have a plan to bring down that debt to GDP ratio so we, as we do stimulus, we have some. So that's the second. And then the third is more like, we're not going to get that plan, you know, in given today's politics, so we should really just do it and not worry so much about fiscal space. But I think most politicians who are not sort of a Tea Party variety probably fit into the second bin.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I just had one more thought on the interest rate part. And I was just thinking of what the argument that someone would make on the raise rates faster would be. I'm hoping Mike Prell, maybe during the Q&A, we'll speak on this also from the audience. You know, I can imagine someone saying, well, look, you know, the economy is just not very interest elastic, right? And sort of we've pushed forward all the activity. And so we raise rates, you know, Fed funds rate at 1% is not, you know, it's not like there's all these projects that are not going to be done. And, oh, well, if your argument there is it's the wealth effect, right, the market's going to get, you know, clobbered, you know, is that really the kind of growth that we want to rely on, right? We want to, you know, basically rely on rich people having assets. And anyway, I think that's the argument. I'm not sure it's a powerful one, but it seems like maybe Rich and John, I don't know if that am I mischaracterizing what someone might say in opposition?
Yeah, that's exactly what Mike would say. No, I'm just kidding. that argument is made. It's still not clear under that argument that there's some future stabilization benefit out of being at one, so that you can go. I'd like to be at one so that I can go back to zero. It's hard to make that work.
Another point. I had a slide on this, but I think it's important to make the point. We, at least folks in my generation, we came up at a time when we talked about the Fed as setting the interest rate and the entire yield curve of interest rates. And, you know, those days are long gone. And I had a slide that said that, you know, what happens in Beijing and Riyadh is important for 10-year treasuries as what happens in Washington. And I really believe that there was a time when I would have argued, well, the front end of the yield curve is, you know, the Fed's got that under control. And increasingly now with negative rates in Europe, even that is very much in place. So I think even though the Fed is the most important central bank in the world, it does not set the entire path of interest rates. And the further out you go, which is relevant for housing and capital spending, the less relevant the Fed is. Ironically, the Fed had more control over interest rates when it was irresponsible in the 70s because there was a huge inflation premium. And by bringing down inflation, you brought down rates. Now that the Fed and other central banks are good at what they do and that inflation premium is small, there's much less leeway to move around rates than perhaps a lot of people believe. And so for those of you who think rates are low, if that is a global development that will persist for 5 or 10 years, that gives you a different view on fiscal sustainability than if you think we're mean reverting back to 2006.
Let me actually ask a little bit more on the fiscal space question. So I think, you know, you've made your point. It's clear. We don't think there's a trigger. We know that higher is less fiscal space than lower. Have we learned anything, though, during the recession about the relationship between interest rates and debt, about how much fiscal space there might be? Have we changed our mind about how, you know, what those parameters are?
I think we have to have learned that there's more fiscal space than we thought.
Yeah.
That markets are less worried about not just the high level of debt, but also, what the trajectory of debt is under current law. Of course, it's impossible to know what markets expect themselves, but it's hard to think of plausible scenarios that markets have in mind that lead to declining debt to GDP over the next 10 years, the next 25 years. So I think we've learned that markets are a little less sensitive than we would have thought. But we still think that those relationships are going to normalize over the next 5-10 years. So which is to say that we think that as aggregate demand continues to improve over the next several years, we will see increases in interest rates that are consistent with the levels of deficits and debt that we project. So I don't think the relationship's broken.
Uh-huh.
So I'd like to just inject a note of how much uncertainty I think there is in this relationship. I completely agree with everything that's been said. But you know, over the period since 1990, Japan's debt-to-GDP ratio has monotonically risen and is now at 3 times the level of ours. And at the same time, their borrowing costs have monotonically fallen, and they're now borrowing not at 150 basis points, but at 10 basis points, or minus 10 basis points. So the thought that I agree, we don't know where the trigger is, but sometimes when you say that, you might be leaving the implication, but surely we're in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
We're not even sure we're in the neighborhood.
And just to clarify, I'm not even sure that we know there's a trigger.
Which
comes back to the point that I think it's not just important. I've said this before, but it's not just important to think about the level of debt to GDP. It's to think about what the trajectory is. And so if investors credibly thought that debt to GDP was going to rise off into infinity over some finite time period, you know, then all bets are off. So clearly what investors and people who are lending to the federal government, clearly their expectations for what's happening to debt to GDP over some long period of time have to matter really importantly.
They think we're going to adjust. They don't know how. But in some sense, every time someone says we're not going to cut, you know, this tax, we're not going to raise spending, or, you know, we're not going to cut spending, we're not going to raise taxes, that should make investors a little bit more nervous.
That's right.
So before I turn to the audience, I just want to ask a couple questions on automatic stabilizers. So one question is, and this is sort of related to the automatic stabilizers, which is, have we also learned from the recession that they may have much deeper, longer-lasting impacts than we thought? And then I wanted to ask about your work-sharing idea, and how do those sort of relate to each other? How important could that be as a response?
Well, I mean, I think I can't speak so much that, you know, we've learned that automatic stabilizers have made some kind of a long-term difference, with the following very significant exception. There's been a growing and really, I think, rich and important literature on the benefits of the safety net to long-term outcomes in the lives of kids and their families. So if you look at the family, go back to the beginning of food stamps where it was kind of unfolding throughout the country seriatim, and you looked at families, kids of families that got it and kids of families that didn't, you track them over their lifetime, you do the same thing for Medicaid, EITC, even some quality Head Start programs, you can find really long-term differences in positive outcomes, earnings, healthcare, employment, that suggest that these programs are much more than just consumption. They're in a form of investment. You then couple that with some of the work I associated with the economist Till Van Wachter, but others, showing the damage of particularly long-term unemployment, and you get a feel for how important the kinds of UI interventions that Ben was talking about are. Third, and this one is huge in my view, and I think it, I'd be interested in Wendy's view on this. This idea that Wendy kind of alluded to, the economists call hysteresis, the idea that when the economy is depressed for long periods of time, so long-term unemployment stays highly elevated for a long time, it's not just a problem in the present. It actually diminishes the supply-side growth factors of the economy, both in terms of labor force participation and in terms of capital deepening. And you can see, if you look closely, that, in fact, CBO's potential came down significantly, and some economists, and I'm one of them, believe that this has is a very serious consequence of inadequate response to the downturn. It has long-term macroeconomic negative results.
So to say a couple things. So the question of how hysteresis matters and whether or not hysteresis is a thing that where short-term downturns always affect long-term potential, and they always affect it cycle after cycle, and they're doing it in the current cycle just in the way they always have. It's just that the current cycle is bigger. Whether or not that's the right story, or we don't typically see this kind of hysteresis, but we see it in this current downturn because this current downturn's special. Or then the third possibility is that there really isn't hysteresis, and I think typical macroeconomics would have normally put hysteresis aside, and we would have said, in fact, the whole point that we're cyclically adjusting things like GDP is we're trying to take out the cycle, which is to say that we're actually trying to look at these structural factors that are driving the economy because we don't think that the cycle is affecting the structural factors. So it's really complicated to tease all of those things apart. What we've certainly seen in the last cycle is that capital was hit, that investment was hit hard enough that there are long-lived effects of the capital deepening, as Jared mentioned. There are long-lived effects of the declines in investment that we saw right after the recession. On other fronts, I think CBO has actually been surprised recently that hysteresis has been, that types of hysteresis have actually been less of a factor than we would have expected. And one place to look is the unemployment rate. So we had previously estimated that what was happening in the labor market and with long-term employment and other factors would have longer-term scarring effects on the unemployment rate. And we've since revised that away, given what we've seen with the unemployment rate and with long-term unemployment coming down. So hysteresis is complicated. The one, but just because Jared mentioned the revisions that CBO has made to our projections to potential since before the recession, since 2007, and I think you had shown them in your slides, Rich. One thing that I will say is that we actually don't attribute most of the revision. So I don't know if you can sum it up, the picture that Rich showed of potential GDP in 2007 looking like this and potential GDP in our current projections looking like that, and there's a lot of daylight between them. We actually don't attribute most of that revision to the recession in hysteresis. We actually attribute most of that revision to implausibly optimistic projections for labor force growth and for hours growth in particular, pre-recession. And we were just in retrospect, they were just implausibly fast.
Wanted to jump in?
Yeah, I just had one really quick thought on fiscal, and I agree with a lot of what Jared said. And in some ways that, the long-lived nature of this, that the events of 06, 07, 08, and, you know, are living with us today, or with us today, and, you know, matter socially and politically and you know, very profoundly. So to me, that's why this is so important, getting the policy right, and it goes back to the quality of the fiscal policy. I mean, you know, sort of every dollar burned on, you know, sort of green pork or whatever is a dollar that didn't go to preschool teachers. You know, that's why the quality matters. So
and we didn't have time, and I don't think we necessarily need to do it now, to debate some of the aspects of the Recovery Act. You know, the crazy.
Okay, yeah, no. I should say
the crazy train.
Right. To me, what?
Joe Biden.
Yeah. That's not fair. What is frustrating to me, and you could see the frustration when I was up there, is the reproposing the burning money on high speed rail, the crazy train to nowhere. You know, that to me, that's the hardest part, is that, you know, you want at least some introspection and let's have
some quality. Thing I'm less certain about. I think the green investments, I would argue you've mischaracterized. I think that some of them were a lot more effective than that. And by the way, not to get into it now in the interest of time, the work of Michael Greenwald is very instructive on this point.
Thank you so much. Okay, we're going to open up the audience now. Can you please raise your hand, stand up, the mic will come to you, and tell us who you are and where you're from. Do you want to, this gentleman right here? And we might take a few questions, take two or three questions, and we'll bring it to the panel.
Thanks very much. Phil Suttle from Tudor Investment Corporation. One fiscal and one monetary question, if I may. On the fiscal side, maybe Wendy specifically, it looks to me like we've had an incredibly high elasticity of tax revenues to income in this expansion. In fact, if you look at those charts people were putting up, huge swings in budget deficits relative to what's been quite stable GDP growth. So I wondered if you felt that the automatic stabilizers were actually a little bit bigger than, you know, the little rectangles that you were suggesting, or more to the point, when we get the next downturn, what's the chance that we catapult from a sort of 3% of GDP deficit back to double digits? So that's the fiscal question. On the monetary side, very simple but very complicated question in some ways is, why is there so much focus on the front end of monetary policy, i.e. the Fed funds rate, and virtually no function on the transmission mechanism? Because isn't the problem that what the Fed's been doing in tapping the accelerators just hasn't moved the wheels? So it's that transmission mechanism we should be focused on, not the Fed.
Since those were two questions, let's go. Wendy, you want to take the first one?
I'll let you handle that.
So I don't think that we have been particularly surprised by what's happened to automatic stabilizers, what's happened to revenues relative to taxable income. And so the way I square that with the point that you're making about GDP growth is I am positing that taxable income has moved more than GDP growth, but because the question came to me really fast, I didn't have time to verify that.
And one of you want to take the monetary policy?
I'm going to take that.
You know, I think that's the right question about why is the focus at the short end and not on the transmission mechanism. But the answer is that the focus is very much at the longer end and on the transmission mechanism, where it should be precisely. Especially with the federal funds rate at zero, that's why we're buying why central banks around the world are buying longer-term securities. There was a lot of study done on the basic channels, the wealth channel. How is that being affected by problems where households were, that is still mentioned, were rebuilding their balance sheets? How did that affect the wealth channel? How does has the exchange rate channel changed? Is interest-sensitive spending much less interest-sensitive than it was at one time? So there has been, the focus should be there, and I think the focus has been there.
So I think both of our monetary friends have introduced a really important point in their presentations. Rich focused on this in particular, which is the international dimension. I cannot overemphasize how important that is. Ben Bernanke has, actually since the mid-2000s, has been stressing through his savings glut discussions the critical importance therein, to the point where you're even seeing monetary policy being challenged by these dynamics, such that, you know, countries' lower rates expect their currency to go down and it goes up. That happened in Japan recently, and to the tune of 8%, so it wasn't trivial. When the Fed turned a bit dovish in their meeting about a week ago, I mean, the dollar depreciated sharply. And so those sensitivities, those elasticities are much, in my view, much more important than they've not been unimportant in the past, but they're much more important now.
Back there. Brendan. I'm going to call Mike next. Yeah.
Lloyd Etheridge with the Policy Science Center. I wanted to ask an early warning, prevention and big data question. CBO has been saying for years, decades, that models are not good at turning points. So we are three quarters into a recession and before things happen. But couldn't you today think more optimistically with big data about early warning systems that detect a downward cascade that could start in any of several places and then move much faster with a new repertoire of policy tools?
Take another question before we answer. I'll get to Mike after. Go ahead, back there.
Thank you. This has got me thinking a lot of different directions. Some of the papers I've read imply that there's a lot more than just negative interest rates. And the interest rate is not just a number. It's a correlation. And if you insert money or change a policy, that can give the equivalent of a negative interest rate already. And Rogoff and Reinhardt said that this time it's different, and they kind of meant that it isn't different, but in a way it is different because the definitions of all the variables have changed and keep changing. What goes on in the CPI, stock market goes up, that's good, but the S&P 500 has a way different PE than it had in the 90s, and similarly unemployment is 5%, but the labor participation is lower than it's ever been. I like that diagram of all the lines interconnected. Some of the papers have each of those lines, but they have not just a number on those lines, but each one of those lines is a complicated nonlinear partial differential equation.
Wow. Let us cogitate on that question and move along.
What are the real numbers that are going on here?
One more before we ask. One more right now? Peter.
All good points.
Peter has a question.
This one's for Dr. Clarida. Greg Ip had an article today in the Wall Street Journal, and you were quoted.
Yeah.
And about, so it seems that there's a little bit maybe of a disagreement between you and Dr. Faust, where, and it might not be actually, but you seem to think that helicopter money will happen in the thing you said in the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah.
And I want to know more.
Well, certainly the U.S. would not be at the top or even in the middle, probably close to the bottom of my list. But there are 182 countries in the world, and given the level of specificity of my answer, I am confident. And I will say for my own blogger piece going into details. But as I said in the article, there are different flavors of helicopter money. And I think more likely is what I called in the quote in Greg's piece, disguised helicopter money. The Milton Friedman case, as you announced on January 3rd, that the government's going to issue a huge amount of debt and it's going to place it privately with the central bank, which will extinguish it, and essentially you promise never to raise taxes, and then the issue is how much inflation do you get. We may not see that, but we may see a close cousin of that, which is essentially you run the big fiscal program, you say you're doing QE, and then after 3 years you say, you know what, we just read John Cochran's article, we really should have a big balance sheet. So basically, we're never going to solve this debt. We're going to roll it over forever. So I don't think that's implausible at all, but I don't think that's the U.S., store. So let me be clear.
Barrett, on the big data question, I actually had this idea too, not on a necessarily big data in terms of calling turning points, but for automatic stabilizers to have triggers, are there some triggers that will be faster and earlier than sort of maybe the unemployment rate, or is that something that we could
think
about?
Well, I thought it was a really interesting question, and I must say, and I won't waste your time by trying to answer your good questions. I just don't know enough about it, but I do think that there is probably some there. I know Hal Varian, for example, talks about these ideas using all the input that Google gets. The one constraint that Ben and I had, and we got a lot of input for our trigger discussion, and everybody said it has to be something simple that Congress can sort of understand and deal with, and that kind of leaves you with what the BLS is going to generate, not with, you know, big data.
Yeah. Mike, do you actually want to take on the question of raising interest rates preemptively, or? Yeah. Go ahead.
I think the conventional wisdom is pretty strong on this one. Unlike some other types of conventional wisdom, I'm not going to question it. If I might, just a couple of quick observations about what we've been talking about. And I guess I'm impressed by my profound ignorance, which is even greater than I thought before we went through this financial crisis. But one thing that wasn't mentioned, and I suspect is not a practical issue in terms of thinking about what we might do if there's another recession, so we've embarked in varying ways in different countries on macroprudential regulation, and I don't see that there's a great enthusiasm for thinking about that as a countercyclical tool as opposed to something that just creates an ongoing greater resiliency, but one could envision, in some countries at least, maybe more difficult in the U.S. where we don't have a lot of different tools, but doing something on that front. But going back to this question of interest rates and what we might do, the Fed itself has already shown a concern about the possible effects of persistently low interest rates. So that sort of raises a question about whether they would want to quickly move to still lower interest rates. And the questions of creating financial asset bubbles or other types of bubbles, real malinvestment, to use a term you don't hear from the Fed very much, and I don't think they're very concerned about it, but in some circles, it's especially Republican circles, it's a very big deal. The question of creating further problems in financial intermediation, that's certainly one of the concerns with negative interest rates that we've heard, but you might not even have to go to negative to be concerned about that. I might cite Wall Street Journal article today about the problems of insurance companies with long-term care insurance and raising premiums there. And that's almost a variation on another question of how do consumers respond to lower interest rates. One could envision that there are some consumers who are not so impressed by how it's cheaper to borrow and they could go out and buy another car, but how their retirement savings are being affected and feeling a need, a sort of target saving approach here, so that you might not get the consumption response you're expecting. There's also the... Well, I guess that sort of covers the main ones you hear, but there are a lot of arguments you hear for why it would not be a good thing to go to lower interest rates.
Go ahead, back there. Yeah.
Thank you. Alex Frank from Johns Hopkins SAIS. Quick question both on the fiscal and the monetary side and the impact of regulatory policy in terms of our preparedness. It was briefly mentioned by Professor Wagle here, but I'm kind of curious to hear a little bit more in depth from both the monetary side of the House in terms of the Fed's ability and capacity to deal with things with the impact that we've seen from the regulatory policy on the fluidity of the market.
I'll make a quick fiscal comment just riffing off of Phil. I thought Phil made a good point about some of the large changes in healthcare policy and financial regulations that collided with a recovery that was still finding its legs. And the only thing I would say is that the political timetable doesn't necessarily track with the cyclical one the way you'd always like it to. But we thought we had to, and I was with the administration, the Obama administration, we thought we had an opening to do an historical healthcare reform, and I think we did it, and I think ultimately that will be a history will show that that was a very positive policy change.
Anything else? No. Questions? Woman here, and then why don't you take these two, and then we'll answer them.
I was going to say, while you're doing that,
yeah.
I just think also the regulatory, to me, the regulatory issue is on growth, right? It seems like I'd call it a regulatory surge, and that had to have some effect on growth, right? It's, I don't know if it's, 10 basis points or 100 or 150 basis points, but it's had some impact, and it'd be useful, I think, to do, better cost-benefit analysis or even some cost-benefit analysis and figure out how to undo the wrong regulations in some sense.
And I think on the monetary side or financial system side, it's pretty clear that the regulations have a certain burden. As far as what they've done for resilience, I think the key contribution to resilience has been that financial institutions now have a lot more capital. And that's not particularly all the complicated, the 800-page regulations and the like. I think unambiguously, we know they have a lot more capital, and that unambiguously makes the system more resilient. There's a point at which, requiring too high a level of capital is also a drag, but the system is much more resilient, and the thing you can point out is the capital. We'll spend a long time revising and sorting out the regulations, which are beneficial, which need further revision.
We're going to have the last two questions here and there.
I just wanted to get back to the fiscal space and creating an automatic. Isn't part of the argument for automatic stabilizers that you can build into their design that they turn off and maybe compensate? But also I wanted to ask, how important do you think the fiscal space or our ability to borrow is to the conviction of people that we won't go off that default cliff? And frankly, 2013 was actually horrible. I mean, they spent a lot of time between 2011 and 2013 preparing, and you saw haircuts on short-term treasury bills.
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, I remember Goldman Sachs always puts out these great charts of fiscal impulse, and 2013 was a huge negative. 1.5 points of GDP, you could map that onto a million jobs pretty quickly. And when fiscal impulse went from negative to neutral, you saw things really pick up pretty quickly. So I take your question very seriously. On the triggers, I mean, as Ben, very clearly articulated, the turning on and turning off is what's most important to us, and we think we've come up with ideas that would make them more timely. I would steer people towards a paper that I think was very important. It was actually a Brookings paper, and it sort of goes in a different direction than some of the things Wendy said, which is not a criticism of CBO at all. I think sometimes what happens is the research gets out ahead of CBO, and then if it becomes true, then CBO adapts it later. They're not going to change their views based on a paper or two. But I think that the Long Summers paper in a Brookings paper a little while ago that showed that when there's any degree, when there's even a very small degree of hysteresis, and we have evidence that there was in one of our papers that the degree was larger than that, they argued that the countercyclical stimulus pays for itself. I probably wouldn't go that far because I'm just uncomfortable talking about free lunches, but it becomes a very low-cost lunch. And you can actually see in Europe, in cases where austerity was bitten off big time, that in fact their debt situation worsened, because they hurt their growth so much.
To me, the schizophrenia on this issue is illustrated by the administration. On the one hand, it's decrying the sequester, and I understand that. On the other hand, celebrating the fiscal adjustment, right? And I understand that also. So in some sense, they can't decide which side of the sequester they want to be on, so they're on both. So. Mm-hmm.
All right, last question.
Can I just
say a little bit about the paper that Jared mentioned? So if you take like an infrastructure program that let's say costs $100 billion, and let's say we think it's going to have a rate of return of, let's even say we think right now, CBO estimates right now that the private sector rate of return is 10%. Let's say we think that the infrastructure project will have the same as the private sector rate of return, which is to say it's going to increase GDP every year by $10 billion. the revenue that the federal government will get from that increase in GDP of $10 billion is maybe about $2.5 billion. So that's not very much revenue. And if you think that the increase in borrowing that the government did in order to finance that infrastructure, assuming that that's how they financed it, increased interest rates at all, first of all, that means that they have to finance the $100 billion. But keep in mind that even if you increased interest rates by a trivial amount, our debt load is so high that very small increase in federal borrowing rates also has a negative effect on the deficit, which it's very easy to swamp the increase in revenues that you get from the increase in GDP from infrastructure.
A quick last question.
Yeah, Bobby Pestrong, Citizen. Given the interconnectedness that you've talked about from country to country, several speakers have mentioned that, agreed to that point, how important in advance is it that central banks or others think how they will coordinate their response in the case of a new recession? Or are there competitive advantages that countries can obtain by waiting to see what others do, and therefore it's not advantageous to coordinate response?
Yeah, I can just do that quickly. In theory, there can be. In practice, when people actually, at least among economists, try to quantify and calibrate the gains to cooperation, they're typically found to be pretty small. I think a lot of what we observe in practice, which sometimes we call coordinated policies, are really correlated policies. Countries get hit by common shocks, and it's all in their interest to do the same thing. So, for example, in 2009, there was a global recession. Everybody cut interest rates and did fiscal expansion. Was that coordination, or was that correlation to a common shock? Mm-hmm. So it's a harder problem in when you get into the details than it may first appear to sort that out.
So the mission of the Hutchins Center is to improve the quality of fiscal and monetary policy, which requires things like Jared and Ben's paper of thinking about how fiscal policy could be different, and improving public understanding of those, which requires the cooperation of people like these to spend time explaining to things to us, answering questions, and making PowerPoint slides. Thank everybody for participating and coming. Two, the slides that all the speakers presented are on our website if you want to read the small print. And three, if there's paper or coffee cups at your feet, pick them up and put them in the garbage at the end. Please join me in thanking Louise and our panelists.